All right, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, so hey, thank you so much for taking the time to join, man. I appreciate you connecting, and I'm super excited to get a chance to interview you, man. So what I like to do is kind of paint a story for people to really understand you and what you
Okay.
got going on in the world. So who is Eddie Francis? What about your story? Who are you?
I am a brand strategist and I'm also someone who has a career in higher education and marketing communications, and also I am an award-winning broadcaster. I do have a background in radio. I have a couple of podcasts that I do. So that's who I am. I'm a New Orleanian. I love red beans and rice. I'm a connoisseur of red beans and rice, by the way. And that's who I am, man. I'm my biggest thing is that I am really, really into ethical leadership. That is my huge thing. I believe very deeply in it. So there you go. That's who I am.
No, appreciate that. First off, New Orleans is a great place. Best food,
Thank you.
just food in the entire country. Seriously, best seafood, definitely. Higher education. I'm very intrigued to talk to you a little more about that. So I actually have a little bit of background in higher education. I left it a couple of years ago. I did admissions and career counseling. What got you into higher ed? What all did you do in higher education?
Oh, I really want to hear your
Yes.
story,
I'll get there in a second. Okay.
I actually had a friend who was I had a friend who was actually a chief of staff at a university, and he told me that he was looking for a director of public relations. And so he looked me up and he said, "Hey, you need to apply for this job. We really need somebody who can do it. I think you're going to be great at it. So, why don't you come on board and why don't you join us?" And so that's how I got in. And then when I got in, I was really intrigued with it. And I've worked at three HBCUs, and so with that being an HBCU in my home city and seeing the kinds of students that we were helping, I really, really got into it. But then it just became intriguing to me to, as a PR director, to tell the story of what I believe to be, the most important institution that the world has, or one of the most important institutions that the world has, higher education. And so that became a huge part of my story.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful, man. And you got me thinking of certain questions to ask. HBCUs have always been a very important and intriguing part for, I just think, education in America itself. And so I didn't go to HBCU. I went to PWI. I went to Mizzou. And I used to tell people in admission, especially the black students I would recruit, if we could all afford to go to an HBCU, don't you think that we would, right? And so that's just something I was always important to us. So what do you think is kind of a misrepresentation or thought about HBCUs, so just simply or not true?
They're not diverse. That's probably the biggest thing. Now, ethnically, HBCUs are dominated by Black culture, but diversity doesn't happen just on the spectrum of ethnicity or race of color. Diversity is also the different parts of the country, different parts of the world that people are from. At the HBCU that I've worked at, you've had a large contingent of folks from New Orleans, but you've also had a large contingent of folks from Chicago. Those are two different lifestyles. But then
Way
even
different too, though.
yeah, exactly. And then but even the folks from New Orleans, depends on what neighborhood you're from. It depends on your family background. I was somebody who my parents both had master's degrees, but somebody, I could be sitting in a classroom with somebody whose parents, their first generation, their parents didn't go to college, right? And so I think that is a huge gap of diversity. But then even when you talk about the values with which students were raised, you have, it's funny that I was on Reddit this morning, and I was reading this post on Reddit where this student said, "I'm into anime. I'm a kind of a nerdy kid. Would I fit in at an HBCU?" And I'm sitting there going, "You absolutely would. You have no idea how many black kids in anime. And my son's into it, right?" So it's that's, those are some of the things that people tend not to think about. And then there's religious diversity. You have Christian students, you have students who are Buddhist, you have students who are Muslim, and some of all students who, you know, see life very, very differently. And so that's where you have, that's where you have those dimensions of diversity that are really, really working. So, So that is really, you have to excuse me. I'm going from one place to the other right now, but those are the dimensions of diversity that people really tend not to think about when it comes to HBCUs. And then they can be more ethnically diverse than people realize. So there are more white students than people realize. There are more Asian students than people realize, more Middle Eastern students than people realize at HBCUs. So there are a lot of more Hispanic students. So there are different dimensions of diversity that people really, really tend not to think about.
No, I mean, I think you nailed that on the head. You just hear historically black college and university, and you assume that everybody in that student body is black. And I've always thought that wasn't necessarily, right. I always thought that wasn't necessarily the case. And I've always been an advocate for the students that I work with to always think about those schools. I know that there's a, and I could be wrong, and I think you might be a good guy to maybe get the answer from. There's always been this concept that HBCUs are either underfunded or they have to overcharge so they can keep the funding in the school. Is that an accurate statement, would you say?
Somewhat. The thing about higher education is that the money in higher education, the way it flows, the economics can be really, it can be kind of complex. And there are a lot of things that people don't realize in terms of, you know, how money flows. But most HBCUs, if not all HBCUs, are historically underfunded. There is actually a good book about that called The State Must Provide by Adam Harris. Adam Harris is a writer for The Atlantic, and he graduated from Alabama A&M. And so I actually just finished reading that book. And the stories that he tells about the underfunding, and the very deliberate underfunding, by the way, you know, are just, they're intriguing, they're revealing, and they make you mad. So, there is that. And what people have to think about is that if you are underfunded, if you are under-resourced, then it's really, really hard to operate efficiently. And right. So that is really one of those things where people tend to enter the HBCU space. They tend to look around and go, well, why can't they do anything right? It's not that they can't do anything right. It's the fact that a lot of institutions, you know, a lot of HBCUs don't have the necessary resources to operate at an efficient pace or at capacity, you know. And I see a lot of folks from PWIs make this mistake, because I graduated from a PWI. And the mistake I made was that the first HBCU I went to, man, I walked in with my little cape, you know, thinking I was going to save the day with my little PWI degree. And, you know, I'm just like, oh, y'all need to, if you just operate like a business, you'll be all right. And I had all these assumptions. And, you know, people were like, Do you not think we're working hard? Do you not think we're intelligent? Do you not think we haven't thought about this problem? And I'm going, huh? You know, so yeah, man, you asked a really good question. And it is, higher education funding and economics is really complex, and it's maddening at the same time. And the entire industry, the business model, is just upside down right now. It's just upside down, because it used to be that you had people who would have so much money, the tuition was so much, they would send their kids to school, pay the tuition. But at the time, a long time ago, in days past, these were people who were able to write a check for tuition.
Right.
You don't have that anymore. You know, you just don't have that anymore. So, yeah. You know, we and then you have to think about the fact that, because one problem a lot of people have is they'll watch things happen in HBCUs and say, oh, this is an HBCU problem, when it's really a higher ed problem. Mm-hmm. And we were talking just a few years ago about having more than 4,000 colleges and universities. Now we have fewer than 4,000 colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a lot wrapped up when people start looking at, well, why can't they manage the money? What is going on? There's a lot wrapped up in that stuff.
No, it was Siri wrapped up. Yeah, no, I mean, I won't say it was the only reason I left, but higher ed is a very interesting space. And when you really start paying attention to the ins and outs, especially if you have a certain, let's say, individual agenda or goal, you learn that you are not bigger than the institution. So it does not really matter what you do, or maybe you have to find an institution that fits that. But it's very tough. Yeah. We have so many of them. They turn it upside down, not even get into the political structure, but politics also will influence the state of higher education, even though that's one of several layers. That's going to be an issue. But the kind of transition of it, I could talk about higher ed for an hour and a half easy.
Oh, yeah. You and I need to continue your conversation. I hear that. We get a whole nother conversation. Yeah.
So it broadcasted. Was that something that you studied in school? Like, how did we get to being an award-winning broadcaster? What does that look like?
Man, I'm one of the few mass comm majors, I think, in the entire nation who can say that I went straight into my career from my major. And so I got into it, honestly, you know, it's the old fashioned college story with an internship. I actually had a friend who came to me one day and said, hey, this radio station is looking for an intern. Why don't you go interview? Funny part about that is that I put my suit on so I could do my internship interview. I got to the station. The promotions director, which is the department I was interviewing for, I thought I was interviewing for. She walked in. She goes, why do you have on that suit? And I said, it's an interview, isn't it? And she said, oh, no. You have the internship. We're going to start working today. So take that tie off and roll up the sleeve. And I was like, oh, okay. Pretty cool. I'm like, well, I'm glad I was overprepared, I guess. But that's how I got in, man. I got in through an internship. I actually have been, man, that was over 30 years ago when I started my broadcast career. And then at one point I shifted from music radio. So I started in hip hop and R&B, a station in New Orleans called Q93. And then I went over to another station, which was R&B old school cuts. And that was FM 98 WYLD. And I started doing a talk show. I co-produced and contributed to this talk show called Sunday Journal. And, the guy who actually invited me, the same guy who actually recruited me to do the PR job, a guy by the name of Harold Clark Jr., Hal one day said, yeah, I submitted this interview you did for an award with the Press Club in New Orleans, and you got it. I was like, dang, man. And if any of your folks have heard of her, or if you've heard of her, it was with this sister from Rwanda named Immaculate Ilabagiza. And I interviewed her about her surviving the Rwandan genocides in the 90s. It was a hard interview to get through, actually. But, you know, what one of the treasures of my career to be able to talk to her.
Yeah, man, that's cool how you went in thinking your internship leads to a long path. And so you said hip hop and you just. So you went from hip hop into what was after hip hop?
After the hip hop radio gig was old school R&B. So that was the next radio gig. Then more talk radio, but you know, I had a chance to do a party show where I played old school R&B cuts. That was actually one of my favorite shows. That was the next step after that one.
Okay, so. Since you're from New Orleans, I have to ask, it seems like you might be a little versed in the hip hop space. But how did you feel about Lil Wayne not getting the Super Bowl nod?
I mean, I actually kind of played with this a little bit. And it's funny because New Orleans is a space where culture is so curated because we have a unique culture. And I think what a lot of people thought of that was, listen, New Orleans is a place where culture is specific. And if you're going to do an artist, then Lil Wayne's got to be the one, right? But, I mean, you know, to me, business is business. And so whoever made that decision for whatever business reason they made it, And I'm one of those people, I don't act like I understand what's happening behind the scenes. I have no idea what's happening behind the scenes. Would I like to see Lil Wayne? Sure. I'll be honest with you, though, for a Super Bowl halftime show, as a New Orleanian, I want to see Trombone Shorty. You know, I would rather see him or John Batiste, right? Like, because John Batiste is a bad boy. And I'm sitting there like, y'all are arguing about Lil Wayne, but John Batiste is the man right now. If you're talking New Orleans music, and Trombone Shorty comes in a very close second. It didn't rock my world that Wayne didn't get tapped for it. You know, I'm like, okay, it's business. Who knows who made the decision? Why?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so you're born and raised in New Orleans. Like, this is are you from born and raised in New Orleans? Okay.
Yeah. I grew up walking distance from the French Quarter.
Okay, so now you're really born and raised in New Orleans. What do you think is a big misconception about New Orleans? You know, I've been there a couple times over the past 2-3 years, and you know, I used to, when I got a chance to talk to some people, right, there's people that would just, you know, pick me up from the airport on an Uber or something like that. You know, I always hear like this this tone of New Orleans is very corrupted. New Orleans has a lot of issues. It's like, you know, gentrification is going on. There's a lot of different mixes. So like, from a New Orleanian, as you said, like, what do you think is a misconception about New Orleans that people do not know?
I think the biggest misconception that New Orleans itself is corrupt. The state of Louisiana is corrupt. And after Katrina, when there was funding being sent down from the federal government, a lot of that funding that was supposed to be from New Orleans got intercepted in Baton Rouge. And it went to other parishes around the state. So that wasn't New Orleans' fault. These were people who were in office at the time. And I know North Louisiana likes to believe that they're not corrupt, but they are. It is the entire state. So I think the biggest misconception is that New Orleans operates in this corruption vacuum that nobody else does. And listen, Rashad, I lived in Texas. And I lived in Texas for a little bit. When I started looking at some of the corruption going on in the Texas legislature, I'm going, why are we other time? But it happens everywhere. I mean, there's corruption in every state. I had a friend who grew up in Rhode Island. And when we were talking about government corruption, he just started laughing. And he says, yeah, I'm glad Rhode Island is so small that we get to hide from everybody. And so... So, I mean, that is the thing that probably gets me the most, that there's this misconception that New Orleans operates in this corruption bubble that can be burst.
Yeah. So that makes sense. And I do think corruption happens everywhere. I mean, I also think that a popular city gets the flack of it when it could be, like you mentioned, the entire state. You said you're a brand strategist. What does that look like in today's time? Like, how do you implement that on a day-to-day? Do you help people with that? What does that look like?
Well, one is personal branding. I actually have a client right now who I'm working with, and one of the things that he struggled with was really figuring out how to talk about himself and what makes him valuable to the people he works with. And so what makes him valuable in his industry, what makes him valuable in his personal community. And what we did is we started breaking down what he believed in and started breaking down what his personal mission looks like. And I created a custom brand guide just for him so he can know what to talk about, what kind of content to talk about on social media and that sort of thing. And then even some things he can think about when he talks to people one-on-one in meetings. With organizations, though, I also work with organizations, and what that looks like is trying to figure out how that organization can express itself in a way that really matches the identity that they have. So I have a healthcare client that I'm working with right now, and one of the things that I noticed when I was looking at the website was that they had some of the language on the website was very formal and a little stiff. And so I looked at their mission. I looked at, you know, what it is that they truly believed in as an organization. And I pitched them and said, hey, how about if I start taking a look at some of your copy and rewriting some of your web copy to really reflect the compassion that you have for your patients, and to really, when patients get to the website, they feel as if they are already being cared for. And so that's what brand strategy looked like. In that case, one of the things that I really love about marketing is there is a type of branding called employer branding. And employer branding is something that I love because it really talks about how you can present yourself as an employer of choice, what makes the employment experience valuable for the people who work for you, so that you can attract great talent. You can make sure that the talent were there, they have a great experience, and you can retain the talent that you really need to retain. So that's what brand strategy looks like for me.
So just like so you kind of do brand strategies for kind of anybody and everyone, regardless of their field per se.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, you know, when it comes to organizations, I do better with small organizations because the healthcare organization I'm working with right now, they're a pretty small organization. When it comes to individuals and personal brand strategy, folks who are up and coming, I think are the folks who I probably work best with.
Yeah. And what would you say is the, maybe not the number one key? I know saying number one key could be like a niche driven question. What do you think is a strong key in being successful in a brand strategist?
I think the biggest thing is really understand what the voice of the organization or the person would be, because that's where it can get tricky. So some people, when they think of brand, what they tend to think is, okay, you do this thing, you sell widgets. We're going to make this exciting. But the widget company may not necessarily be an exciting per se company. They may be a very thoughtful company. They may be a company that has a rather reserved presence. So when someone comes in not really paying attention to what the true voice of the client is, that's when the strategy tends not to work out. A great example is higher education. One of the universities where I worked, they were an institution that was pretty laid back. It wasn't an exciting environment, but it was a very, it was a warm and inviting environment for everyone who was there, for the folks who were there. That includes the students, and that included the employees. They wanted to be exciting, though. They wanted to be like other universities. They wanted to be like some of the most well-known HBCUs in the country. So when I talked to them, the hard conversation we had was, you're not those institutions. And so we had to really dig into what the real voice of the institution was. And they said, well, this is really kind of boring. And I said, but this is what the research is telling us. The research is telling us that this is your voice. And, and I'm sitting there going, I don't know. I mean, the research told us this. We surveyed you. We did focus groups with you. And the answers that you gave us, when we broke that data down, this is what you said you were most proud of. And this is where the most value is. And this is what your mission is about. You don't have a football team. You don't have a band. And the thing what they had trouble with was realizing that it was okay. It was okay for them to be that institution. I was a bit more laid back than other institutions. It would have been irresponsible for me to say, you know what, let's go ahead and put a brochure out and we're going to have a bunch of kids. We need this one. Hey, you over here, kid, do a backflip. And, I take a picture of this kid doing a backflip and making it seem like that's what's happening at the university 24/7. That would be irresponsible branding.
Right.
Because students get there and they're just like, well, I saw the backflip picture. It looked like y'all were lit around here, but ain't nobody around here doing backflips. You know, like, nobody in this whole school can do a backflip. And you're just like, that kid graduated. That's the thing. I think for brand strategy, it's really important for people to pay attention to the voice, the personality. And then also a big part of it also is being able to tell your clients some stuff that they may not necessarily want to hear, but realizing that their strength and what they bring to the table, they just have to recognize it as a strength.
Yeah, no, but that sounds like a brand strategist.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
I'm like, I'm sold, man. But I think it also is very true that, you know, people they have people that are really honest with them and assessing what it is that's going on. I think in order to be successful in certain brands, you do have to match what you're speaking. And so when you mentioned the institutional piece, that's very much the truth. I'm thinking big picture. With everything that you've done, and everything that you're currently doing, what do you think has been your ultimate goal in your life? Has it came in alignment to what you thought, or did it go just a totally different direction to where you are, sir?
Oh, it went a different direction, man. Listen, I'll never forget when I was in high school and my mother asked me what I wanted for living, and I told her I wanted to be an actor, which I have to, you know, I want to help some people out there. If your parents are math teachers, if your mom is a math teacher and you tell her you want to be an actor, that's going to be a hard conversation, just yeah. Food for thought. And so, you know, I want to be an actor, but that was something that I thought very seriously about. And it's really funny. You know, on my podcast, I have a podcast called For Our Edification. I interviewed my Lion brother. You know, I'm a member of Alpha Phi Alpha, and I interviewed one of my Lion brothers who's in Hollywood, and I talked to him about his acting career, because he has been full in on his career. And I had to admit to him, I said, you know, this is something I wanted to do, but talking to you, I made a really good choice, because I don't think I would have made it, you know, with a lot of the challenges. So, you know, it has not gone the way that I thought it was going to go when I was in high school, but I am glad it's gone the way it has gone, because I really explored a lot of different things in my career. I pivoted several times. And I think having pivoted several times in my career has really built my sense of resilience and adaptability. And I think those are a couple of strengths that it really helped me. I mean, actually, I would say those are parts of my personal brand. You know, I mean, I am somebody who was prided himself on bouncing back from tough stuff. I prided myself on being being adaptable, or as I like to put it, being intellectually flexible. You know, those are things that I pride myself on. So even though the big enchilada of being an actor was something that just didn't work out the way I thought it might work out, I really have enjoyed broadcasting. I've enjoyed doing marketing communications. At one point, I was a recruiter. I've enjoyed doing all of that stuff. And when I wanted to take the opportunity to perform, I did have a small stint with stand-up comedy. So I did that for a little while. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've tried a bunch of things, man.
Okay. Stay there. Cause that's, I've always told my friends in a joking manner that, I would have loved to have done or to do like a 5-minute stand-up moment just to try it out. What was your experience like with comedy? What was your experience like in comedy?
It was good. It was good. I decided that it wasn't for me to try to go on the road. So my mom was a math teacher. My dad was actually a music teacher because he was a singer. He sang opera. And he was an English teacher. And so I went to him one day and I said, hey, I have this chance to go on the road and do stand-up. What do you think? And he asked me straight up. He said, do you want a family? I said, yeah, I want one. He said, you don't want to go on the road.
Yeah.
Really hard. You can try, but it's going to be hard. And so that's why I decided to just do it as kind of a hobby, to do it locally. But the thing about stand-up that I'm really proud of, again, that gave me an opportunity to build resilience. Because let me tell you something. Every single stand-up comedian is going to have a bad set or has a bad set. Kevin Hart has had bad sets. You know, Jamie Foxx has had bad sets. Eddie Murphy has had bad sets. They've all had bad sets. What really makes a comedian, I think a great comedian is if they keep working and if they just brush it off and if they just keep going. So it's kind of like you hear these commentators say in football, when a cornerback gets beat on a pass and they say, you know what? He has to have a short memory and go back and play the next play. That's what's like a standoff. You tell a bad joke and nobody laughs. Cause I'm telling you right now, Rashad, there's no moral victory in standup. None. Success is if people laugh, and if they don't laugh, it ain't goes hot. And so you have to have a short memory and just do the next joke. But you know, you said that you want to try it out. I would say try it out because it is probably the best form of public speaking training that anybody can have. Because you get up there, you do your thing, you say what you got to say, you got to think fast, and then on top of that, people start heckling you. Well, that's the other thing. Everybody gets heckled. I've been heckled. I hate hecklers. They're the lowest form of life on the earth. That is for the record, by the way. But, you know, you get a heckler, man, you gotta make it through. You either have to figure out how to go back at the heckler, or you got to keep the set going. That stuff builds resilience. It really shows what kind of character you have. You find out a lot about yourself. So, but when you do that good set and people are laughing, it is the best feeling in the world. There's nothing like it. And so I think for people who want to break out of their comfort zone, go do an open mic. Go do an open mic so you can get out of your comfort zone and just live a little.
Yeah, that's the only reason. I have such a respect for the art. And I already have aspirations in public speaking and enjoy it. But I know comedy is different though. I know comedy is like you mentioned, your character will be tested. But I think with confidence you can become good at it. I have no aspirations to travel on the road. Now if it leads me that way, maybe if I got a lucky break, but I don't have any aspirations.
You should definitely do public speaking because dude, you have. So I checked out your podcast before I got on, and I was like, yo, this brother got some pipes. Like, okay, you got the voice, man. So
yeah,
do it, make it happen.
Yeah. So I've been doing podcasting for like 5-6 years. This is my third version of this, a solo trial. I've done two other ones.
You too? Because this the podcast I'm doing is my third time doing a podcast. That's hilarious.
Yeah. So my first one was called Stay You. That was like the 2017-18. It was just like a trial run, see if I can do it. And then I did another one that was important to me, which was called Young, Educated, and Uncertain. And I've just gotten older. And so I didn't feel like that title stuck with me anymore. And then me and my boys, that's how it all started. Me and three of my closest friends, we started one in 2017, 18. It's called Medium Lit. And that was something that we built really fast without any video. And we had no idea what we were doing. And this was like before a podcast got big. And then we tried it again, second time around with video. And then I moved to Chicago for a year and I kind of stopped it. But also there was a point where I learned that this was my lane and my passion, and their passion's just a little different. They used to call me a boss man in that space because I was very, very militant with things. Cause I thought we had to record every week. We needed to drop as much as we can. Cause you're competing with so many different people. You're competing with the world of saturation, so you have to stay relevant as much as you can. So when I used to give them weeks off, they used to cry. But it's something I've been doing for a while, man. And so I've always heard the voice thing. I think truly right now I'm honestly just getting into the space of comfort with myself, and I've done a lot of interviews. And I guess I will be honest with you, man, about a month ago I was about to be done because I was doing it by myself, and I'm like, I don't feel like interviewing people again. And I think that was just me conflicting with my ego. I think God led me to Threads. And then I'm like, let me just try to see what I can get. And then that posts and everybody start commenting. I'm gonna get these emails. I'm gonna send some feelers out. And I'm like, wait, these people are actually booking? I was like, hold on. I wasn't prepared. So, but even like today, man, you're my third or my fourth one. So I got four back to back to back. And I was sitting there thinking, I'm like, oh, this is a real thing. But it also has brought a lot of like rejuvenation and also just being able to connect with people for all over. So I do think this is God reminding me, like, you are supposed to do this in your capacity. And I'm very grateful to have had a chance to connect with you, man, and looking forward to connecting with you a bit more. I do have one more question for you. I like to ask everybody before they leave, what does it mean to be human to you?
Oh man, what a question at this time. You know what it means to be human is, to me, it means to see other people's humanity, and to realize that people are people, and that you can't control anybody else. You can only understand who they are. The more you try to control people, the more frustrating they become in life. Because this somebody does something that's out of your control, it drives you nuts. And so I think what it means to be human is to just really respect and appreciate other people's humanity, to understand their humanity, and to realize that, you know, you really, really have to stay in your own lane as a human being. And to really just make sure that people have space to be who they are. I was debating back and forth with people who I knew about the election, and, you know, someone was expressing displeasure about people from the LGBTQ community. And I was just like, well, what are you going to do about it? What can you do about it? And by the way, are they bothering you? Like, what are they doing to you? And he didn't have an answer for it, except for he just thought it was an abomination of nature. And I'm just sitting here going, yeah, okay, that's weak. That's water weak. It's really weak, because if they aren't bothering you, you know, just let them be human beings, and you be a human being too. And now if somebody rolls up on you and does something they're not supposed to do, I hear you. But if they're not bothering you, just let people be people. So to me, that's what it means to be human. And I hope that makes sense.
No, that makes total sense. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate you taking the time. I can tell you're a busy man. You did a whole interview in the car.
It makes me look important, man. So
no, very
just so everybody knows, I'm very important. Okay. I'm in the back seat of a car doing a podcast interview. That was the point of the OEB.
Yeah, I'm like, this guy's in the car. Like, this guy means business, man. So where can people find you on social media?
On social media, people can find me on Threads, EddieFrancis06, same thing on Instagram, TikTok, and then you can also find me on YouTube. LinkedIn is where I tend to really do a lot of commentary, of course, business-related commentary. But if you go to my website, eddiefrancis.com, then you'll see all of my social handles. And feel free to connect with me. I would love to connect with people.
All right. Well, hey, as always, for those who are listening, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite audio platform. And always make sure to connect with those people that I'm connected with, because these are great people doing great things. And I am a true believer that social media works. So those who are always in the contemplation, do it. So appreciate you all. Until next time. Peace.